This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for October 2015. I'm Don Scher, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Lindsay Garbutt, assistant editor for the magazine. This month on the podcast, we're going to hear from three poets in the current issue, including Camille T. Dungy.
But mostly, we get grackle, grackle, grackle.
Matt Hart.
The friend lives half in the grass and half in the chocolate cake.
And Jennifer Chang.
Why I chose never, I'll never know.
And once again, we're joined by Christina Pugh, the consulting editor for the magazine. We've asked her to pick a poem from the issue to read for us. And Christina, you've chosen Let the Light Stand by Corey Messler.
Yes, this is the first time Corey Messler has been in the magazine. And he's not only a poet and novelist, but he also runs Burke's Bookstore with his wife in Memphis, Tennessee.
And that's my hometown. And though I don't know Corey personally, I grew up going to Burke's Bookstore, which was pretty much the only place you could see real books like poetry books when I was a kid. So I'm very fond of Burke's.
Christina, before you read the poem, why don't you tell us why you liked it and anything we should be listening for?
Well, I really liked the mood of this poem. It's very upbeat and playful. And it contains some wordplay that you might listen for as I read it. But as you'll see, the wordplay also tells an interesting story. Let the light stand. Let the light stand for nothing but illumination. Let the naked man and woman out for air. Let the curtain hide only another side of the curtain. Let the food consumed be consummated. Let the consommé be a dish. Let the dish into the bedroom because she is there for the cat. Let the cat be cool as miles. Let it all happen again if you can. Let it happen again if you can. Let the first word spoken during intercourse be the only definition you require. Let need be need. Let love be need also, if need be. And let it all happen again because it can. Clearly, this is also a poem in the litany tradition, the let the, you know, you think back to the English poetic tradition with poets like George Herbert and so on and so forth. But this is clearly not a religious poem, but more of a celebration of the body and so on.
Well, the illumination is, you could say, quasi-religious. I mean, it is suffused with something spiritual enough to raise us above and outside that lovely world he outlines with the consommé and the cat, cool as Miles Davis, and the intimacy being described. And the naked man and woman are kind of Adam and Eve, you know? So I kind of like that there's a sort of, no pun intended, light touch in the poem. I mean, for a poem with insistent syntax like that, it's gentle. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, the thing that struck me on reading it the first time was how lovely it was instead of imploring people. Mm-hmm. It's much gentler than that.
I think it has a sort of plain-spoken sexiness about it. Mm-hmm. And I like the way that let is an imperative in the way that let there be light. There's a sort of conjuring happening of these images throughout the poem, but there's also a sort of leave them be aspect to saying let the curtain hide only another side of the curtain. It's kind of insisting on not making these images too metaphorical.
Yeah, that was one of the things that interested me too, and just that nothing but illumination beginning there and thinking about how that kind of wants to be, as you said, only the other side of the curtain. And yet, as Don was saying too, once it says illumination, it's into something else. It's into another register. And one of the things that I really like about the poem is the way that it does this kind of interesting dance with metaphor, wanting to resist it and yet letting it in almost against its own will in certain ways. And I liked that push-pull aspect of it.
And the way it's laid out on the page is very deft in that regard too. I mean, almost anybody can pull off line breaks and make them sort of clever, but this is quite taut and T-A-U-T. Yeah. And so let the light stand for nothing but illumination. It's sort of pithy in the right ways. Camille T. Dungy has written 3 books of poetry and edited 3 anthologies. We have a poem of hers this month that's from a series called Frequently Asked Questions.
I'm just baffled by the questions people ask me in relationship to who I am in the world. And so I started answering the questions.
Those questions include, is it difficult to get away from it all now that you're a mother? Do you have big plans for her first birthday? Are you going to have another child?
Questions with seemingly obvious answers that on larger investigation are pretty confounding for a number of reasons.
And race is one of those reasons. In the October issue, we have frequently asked question number 10. Do you see current events differently because you were raised by a Black father and are married to a Black man?
I couldn't quite figure out how to answer the question directly.
In other words, this poem is not a straight answer to a straight question.
Though it seems like the answer to the question is completely off target, nothing in my life is disconnected from that question.
Here's the poem.
Frequently Asked Questions, number 10. Do you see current events differently because you were raised by a Black father and are married to a Black man? I am surprised they haven't left already. Things have gotten downright frosty, nearly unbearable. A mob of them is apparently mouthing off outside when I put down my newspaper and we all gather to stand beside my daughter in the bay of kitchen windows. Quisculus quiscula. This name sounds like a spell which, after its casting, will make things crumble into a complement of unanswerable questions. Though, if you need me to tell you God's honest truth, I know nothing but their common name the morning we watch them attack our feeder. I complain about the mess they leave, hulls I'll have to sweep up or ignore. My father, who I am thankful is still alive, says, we could use a different kind of seed. A simple solution. We want that brown bird with the shock of red, the northern flicker. We want western bluebirds, more of the skittish finches. But mostly, we get grackle, 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 all day long. Can it be justifiable to revile these harbingers? They scoff all we offer, and, being too close and too many, scare other birds away. My husband says, look at all those crackles. I almost laugh at him, but the winter air does look hurtful loud around the black flock. Like static is loud when it sticks sheets to sheets, so they crackle when pulled one from another and sting. My father, who is older now than his older brothers will ever be, promises he will solve the problem of the grackles and leaves the window to search for his keys. The dawn sky, blue breaking into blackness, is what I see feathering their bodies. The fence is gray, the feeder is gray, the aspen bark. Gray hulls litter the ground, but the grackles, their passerine claws, 3 facing forward, 1 turned back, around the roost bar of the feeder, are so bright within their blackness, I pray they will stay.
Well, she's right that it's not a direct answer to the almost too direct question that has been posed. I like the way the poem only refers to those so-called current events in the initial question through some very oblique and interesting sorts of means, like, you know, a mob of them is apparently mouthing off outside when it's the Grackles. And of course, talking about the father, the black father who is older now than his older brothers will ever be, his longevity in the face of the diminished lifespan expectancy for African-American men, perhaps. It's doing an interesting narrative here.
Well, and that narrative is connected to Camille T. Dungy's role as one of our best nature poets. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think a lot of people probably wouldn't want to be called a nature poet or a sort of eco-poet. But what's happened here is the translation from this sort of historical sense of nature as being stuff that grows in animals and all that stuff to the nature in which we are going to have to survive, and that it's a struggle. And she makes that struggle real, but also redeems it, as a fantastic poet can do, mm-hmm. by using the language to lift it out of the ways that we're sort of stuck thinking about things ordinarily.
Yeah, I mean, I think the asides that you were talking about, Christina.
My father, who I am thankful is still alive.
You know, the way they're sort of bracketed in M dashes.
Who is older now than his older brothers will ever be.
She ends it with one last aside that I thought was particularly interesting, which was about the passerine clause.
Three facing forward, one turned back.
It always interests me what details poets decide to include and what to leave out. And I think this particular detail is so striking to me because it's not only a sort of image for how to live your life, you know, looking forward and looking back at the same time, but also it sort of represents the images of these people watching the Grackles. Mm. There are four of them, the daughter, her husband, herself, and her father, and the father has turned away to go look for his keys. So I thought that was such a beautiful way of tying the poem together and tying the people and the birds together.
Well, in that moment, too, the father reaching for his keys is just one of those instantly memorable things you find in a poem. And it's at the heart of this poem, too. It sort of takes a gesture and it makes the poetry out of it, but it remains a real moment, a memory. Mm-hmm. I think poets are so observant. You know, they are kind of like birds feathering a nest. They pull a little thing here, an image here, a memory, and they sort of make something, a structure out of it that is meant to provide sustenance and shelter. It's a kind of poem I didn't, to be honest, think could be written anymore in the times that we live in, and yet here it is. It's miraculous. This is Matt Hart's first time in poetry. His most recent book is Debacle, Debacle, and he's the editor of Forklift Ohio, a journal of poetry, cooking, and light industrial safety. I'm not making that up.
His poem in the October issue is called The Friend, and it's a kind of thought experiment.
When I was writing it, I was thinking about the fact that as dark as the world often seems, it's easy to imagine every single next person you meet as your next worst enemy. And I wondered if it's possible to imagine that every next person you meet could be your best friend.
Here's the poem.
The Friend, for Nate Pritz. The friend lives half in the grass and half in the chocolate cake, walks over to your house in the bashful light of November or the forceful light of summer. You put your hand on her shoulder or you put your hand on his shoulder. The friend is indefinite. You are both so tired. No one ever notices the sleeping bags inside you and under your eyes when you're talking together about the glue of this life, the sticky saturation of bodies into darkness. The friend's crisis of faith about faith is unnerving in its power to influence belief, not in or towards some other higher power, but away from all power in the grass or the lake, with your hand on her shoulder, your hand on his shoulder. You tell the friend the best things you can imagine, and every single one of them has already happened, so you recount them of great necessity, with nostalgic atomic ferocity, and one by one by one until many. The egg birds whistle the gargantuan trees. The noise rocks fall twisted into each other's dreams, their colorful paratrooping, their skinny, dark jeans, little black walnuts to the surface of this earth. You and the friend remain twisted together, thinking your simultaneous and inarticulate thoughts in physical lawlessness and chemical awkwardness. It is too much to be so many different things at once. The friend brings black hole candy to your lips and jumping off the rooftops of your city, the experience. So much confusion. The several layers of exhaustion and being a friend with your hands in your pockets and the friend's hands in your pockets. Oh, bitter black walnuts of this parachuted earth. Oh, gong birds and apple flocks. The friend puts her hand on your shoulder. The friend puts his hand on your shoulder. You find a higher power when you look.
Great to hear him read it.
Yeah.
One of the things that is so terrific about this is just the way the poem is almost a menagerie of diction. You have things like the noise rocks and the egg birds coexisting with the, you know, crisis of belief that's happening with a friend, you know, sort of a little bit more philosophical. So I kind of feel like we have Montaigne and Dr. Seuss together in one poem or something, and it really works.
Yeah, that definitely struck me too, this sort of stickiness of life, all these different things stuck together of, as you said, the philosophical, but also the sort of strange and the fantastical in a way. What really struck me about the poem was, I guess, the last two lines.
The friend puts his hand on your shoulder. You find a higher power when you look.
That last line seems to kind of ring out with a bigger idea, which to me comes from the fact that higher power kind of rhymes with shoulder in a way. And I think it draws this connection between friendship and higher powers in the way that we sort of move through the world, that this sort of indefinite friend, as he says, could be the higher power.
Well, there's also the higher power that people reach for when, for instance, they're in a 12-step program, as so many writers are, and their friends too. It's sort of that notion of a friend is somebody who shepherds you into a better life, or at least a life if you didn't have one. And what's really interesting to me too is that you could also, though I don't think Matt Hart intends this, but as a reader, I feel like part of that higher power is poetry. And so in the beginning of the poem where there's a line that says, "The friend is indefinite," as the poem sort of unfolds, the friend becomes more definite. Things start happening once you take that notion out of the abstractness.
You tell the friend the best things you can imagine, and every single one of them has already happened. So you recount them of great necessity.
You tell the friend the best things you can imagine. Again, what poetry does. And in a way, it's like when you read a poem, it is like beginning a friendship. It's like you're undertaking this relationship, deciding how you're going to go about it, using your intuitions and feelings to figure out whether this is good company or not. And so I really like that about the poem. Again, I don't think that it was written to serve that particular purpose. I just think that's part of how all this works, that with the layers of confusion and exhaustion, out of all that materializes, if you're lucky or if you work at it or both, a friend.
And what's fascinating to me is that, as you say, we have the indefinite friend. The friend is indefinite, which is such a terrific sentence. But the poem opens with, for Nate Pritz, a dedication to a real poet. Is the person to whom the poem is dedicated, is that person the indefinite friend? In a way, the indefinite friend is the ideal friend, you know, as this poem progresses. As Lindsay was saying, right, the idea that it's almost like through interacting with this friend, you gain access to that higher power, however cliched in some way that higher power might be. I was kind of fascinated by the definiteness of the proper name of Nate Pritz, and then the friend is indefinite, the kind of back and forth between those two things that, of course, could be many ways of interpreting all that.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of wacky, but I have the idea of The Friend as being the name of some kind of 19th century periodical. Mm. And I don't say that glibly because I think there was a conception. And the reason I mention is that Matt Hart is an editor as well as a terrific writer. But I mean, Forklift Ohio is a terrific magazine. It's really cool and everybody should go look for it because once you see it, you'll see it doesn't look like other magazines. I won't say any more about that. And so it occurs to me that there is sort of a thing that this particular poet editor has absorbed where the idea that you do something to provide a kind of fraught companionship, it is an impulse that writers and editors alike have. I mean, it is a real impulse that is indefinite in certain ways and that the job that you do periodically or repeatedly is to make something indefinite definite. This is somebody who knows how to do this stuff and has thought a lot about it and throws everything into it. And to me, that's a remarkable accomplishment. Jennifer Chang is the author of one book of poems, The History of Anonymity. In the October issue of the magazine, we have a poem of hers called A Horse Named Never.
A few years ago, Jennifer Chang was asked to write a poem for an anthology about Thomas Jefferson and Monticello, Jefferson's plantation just outside of Charlottesville, Virginia. Jennifer Chang had been a student at the University of Virginia.
There was an assumption that I'd have some kind of association with it or memory of it that might be of interest to the anthology. And it was a poem that I resisted writing for a very long time until I met A Horse Named Never at a totally different location from Charlottesville.
Here's the poem.
A Horse Named Never. At the stables, each stall was labeled with a name. Biscuits stood aloof. I faced always, invariably, his clockwork tail. Crab knew the salt lick too well. Trapezoid mastered stillness. A midnight mare, she was sternest and tallest, her chest stretched against the edges of her stall. I was not afraid of Never, the chestnut gelding, so rode his iron haunches as far as Panther Gap. Never and I lived in Virginia then. We could neither flee nor be kept. Seldom did I reach the little mountain without him, the easy crest making valleys of indifferent grasses. What was that low sound I heard, alone with Never? A lone horse, a lodestar, a habit of fear. We think of a horse less as a history of one man and his sorrows than as the history of a whole evil time. Why I chose Never, I'll never know. I fed him odd lettuce, abundant bitterness. Who wore the bit and harness? Who was the ready steed? Never took the carrot, words by my own reckoning, an account of creeks and oyster catchers. Our hoof house rested at the foot of the mountain, on which rested another house more brazen than statuary. Let it be known, I first mistook gelding for gilding. I am the fool that has faith in Never. Somewhere a gold door, burdened with apology, refuses all mint from the yard.
That's a hard thing to do when you think about it, being asked to write a poem about Thomas Jefferson. And you know, Jefferson's story is so fraught with the things we've discovered about him and his life in that plantation outside of Charlottesville, and that Jennifer Chang was a student at the University of Virginia. That it's just so fascinating to me how she's able to take this commission and sort of fearlessly weave together different strands of history, her own sort of lines of poetry and sounds that go with them, and come up with something fascinating because she doesn't sort of go after Jefferson in a clumsy and obvious way, but she shows up the complexities of the situation from the standpoint of somebody like her in our time and in her situation, encountering it and not in the way that you encounter it in, say, school or a book somewhere.
Yeah, it would be very easy to play with this concept of Never when using it as a proper noun or a name, but this is a very serious poem. And I think especially that quote that she has in italics there,
We think of a horse less as a history of one man and his sorrows than as the history of a whole evil time.
Which is a play on Yeats's sentence about King Lear. So instead of horse, he says, we think of King Lear less as a history of one man and his sorrow than as a history of a whole evil time. And so this one line, for me, kind of turns the whole poem. It turns her relationship with this either real or, you know, figurative horse into being a more problematic relationship mm-hmm. as well, that this horse mm-hmm. has become a sort of gilding for her, and she's interrogating that relationship as part of a larger mm-hmm. history.
Well, and Jefferson's relationships too, including mm-hmm. with, you know, the horse.
Right.
Why I chose never, I'll never know.
Man, that just about sums it up.
Not to go too psychoanalytic on it, but that gelding, you know, the idealized castrated horse is kind of fascinating. It's like what Lacan would call the imaginary, right? The idea of like something that you see in the mirror that's not really real, right? That can neither flee nor be kept. And so it does seem to me, yeah, that it's this indictment in a certain way of kind of a whole imperialist enterprise that's about gilding the gelding, perhaps.
And that devastating last line, somewhere, a gold door burdened with apology refuses all mint from the yard. Mint being in great profusion down in the South and sort of a great survivor of just about everything. But I love that phrase, burdened with apology, because it makes the apologetics for history, they're too simple. They don't. You can make excuses or pardon things in history and they somehow, you know, you don't feel that there's a possibility of, as we might say, reparation being made. Mm-hmm. There's a difference between mitigating circumstances and justice. That's all for this month. Christina, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks to you, Don and Lindsay.
You can read everything you heard on this podcast in the October 2015 issue of Poetry Magazine or online at poetrymagazine.org.
You can also read the magazine and listen to this podcast on the Poetry Magazine app. It's free to subscribers, or if you're not a subscriber and you really ought to be, you can purchase an issue in the app itself. Look for the Poetry Magazine app in the iTunes Store and on Google Play.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Lindsay Garbutt.
And I'm Don Scher. Thanks for listening.